Hey there, coffee lovers. Do you want to make your morning cup of Joe something special? Let's talk about Joe Bean Coffee, a gem right here in Rochester. I'm Chris Lindstrom, host of the Food About Town podcast and co-founder of Lunchador. I've been a longtime fan of Joe Bean. Kathy, Dina, and the whole team are passionate about their coffee and this city, and it comes through in every cup of Joe Bean Coffee that I brew at home. Joe Bean has been a part of Rochester for years, over a decade, building lasting community and a sense of belonging for everyone who loves coffee. Next time you need beans, head over to Joe Bean's Roastery at 565 Blossom Road in Rochester or shop online at joebeanroasters.com. Even better, subscribe to Joe Bean's Perpetual Joy and you'll receive freshly roasted beans on your schedule and never be without your favorite coffee. Joe Bean is more than just coffee. It's a community, a commitment, and a cup full of care.
This is Evan Dawson. If you like conversations that take you beyond the headlines, join me on Connections. Every day, we dig into the issues shaping Rochester with the people living them, researching them, even trying to change them. No hot takes, no shouting most of the time. Just real conversations that keep you involved in your community. Listen to Connections wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Dialed In. I'm Wade Reed, and today we have a special treat for you. We are going to be playing our conversation we had out at Ugly Duck Coffee on December 18th with Nan Tran of Peaks Coffee Company and myself, where we talked about natural processing and beyond. And as we say at the beginning, there's a lot of beyond. So you can always find us on Instagram and maybe soon on Substack. We used to do that. Enjoy this episode.
Our distinguished guests this evening. distinguished. Wade, founder of Aporia Coffee Roasters, located in this fine city of Rochester. And Nan is the coffee director at Peaks Coffee in Syracuse, New York. So super, super stoked to have them here with us to share their knowledge and perspective on natural processed coffees and beyond, which we met twice previous to this conversation. And let's just say we've got it very rabbit holey in very many ways. So we're trying to keep this a little bit more succinct.
There's a lot of beyond.
Yeah, yeah, I'll say that.
There's definitely a lot of beyond.
So we're psyched to like just kick this off because we can always go more in depth into any area that we have available to us. And that's what's so wild about coffee. And that's what's exciting about having spaces like this to do this in. And that's like a big reason why we're doing these industry gatherings first and foremost, but also a reason why we can just be present and share knowledge that we all have together and ask questions and be open and be able to learn from each other and learn from folks in our industry that are right in our region, which is...
Yeah, because I will yap at you when you're on shift, but yep. Like it's not the ideal time. So really cool of Rory and the team to make this time for us.
So that's kind of like the quick aspect of this. I know Nan is really interested to know how many folks actually work in coffee.
Yeah. Raise your hand who's working in coffee. Oh, so we do have some.
I told you.
Okay. Awesome. Awesome.
So we're going to kick it off with kind of the foundations of processing and in an over kind of like bigger umbrella first, just to like get us going. And I would love for Wade, can you tell us just like what natural processed coffee is?
Yeah. I mean, and in broad strokes, you know, coffee is a tree. Like, I know we're not really accustomed to thinking of it that way, but like, I think that's kind of where you need to start when you're thinking about processing, because these are fruits that resemble cherries growing on a tree. And when you take them off that tree, you're actually trying to get to the seed inside. And so processing is how we do that. And there's like, you know, essentially like four layers of stuff to get through. And
wash processing is its own kind of way of doing that and controlling the process a lot more. Natural is saying, hey, we got a big sun up there in the sky, and we got some space. Let's lay these out. Let's just let the sun do what it does to the cherries and go from there. Once it's dried enough, we'll just crack it right off there, and then we'll take those seeds out. So that is kind of the simplest version, right? Like, obviously you need a lot of space. You don't want there to be too many layers of the cherries like laying on top of each other because they share moisture. Moisture can't, you know, escape in that situation. So you've got to be moving them around and keeping them, you know, out of rainfall, keeping the sunlight on them. And so
it's like a huge process of turning them over.
Exactly.
And making sure they don't spoil.
Yep. And so the whole idea is just to get from that that fruit to the seed that we can then, you know, roast and create the beverage we all love. And there are a lot more ins and outs, but I think, like, did I answer the question?
Yes.
And beyond. There it is.
Yes. And, you know, before we even really dive into, there's that aspect of the natural process coffees, but natural process coffees aren't new. So can we, Nan, do you want to talk about how they've been around for decades and why?
Yeah, I mean, it's been around for decades just because it is the easiest, the simplest way to process a coffee. There are countries that don't have access to fresh water to use that. So it's kind of between like a necessity almost. This is like an agricultural product, so we don't want to overuse the soil. Yeah, I don't know if that answered everything, but.
Yeah, it totally answers it. And I think one of the second largest producing country in the world, Brazil, is a big factor in natural processed coffees and is a big country that holds a lot of space for that. So during our conversations before this, Nan made a great point. Do you want to talk about that again?
Remind me.
If we weren't processing naturally processed coffees in that way, what would
the happen? Way we would stress their water system would, yeah,
just oh, yeah.
would ruin agriculture across the country. I mean, on that scale, it's absolutely impossible to wash that much coffee.
Yeah.
As opposed to like Ethiopia, you know, also another natural mm-hmm. process haven, a place that we get a lot of natural processed coffees.
Super dry climate. It's pretty
it's
much perfect for that, but
exactly.
Yeah, again, not available. So
yep,
kind of forced into doing natural processed coffees.
And then compare like a country like Colombia, where you know, the FNC, the main regulatory body overseeing like coffee growth, was for decades training like you only wash coffees, and they produce a lot of coffee. It's a huge part of their economy, but the FNC was very adamant that we are only washing coffees, and they're willing to make that trade-off because they perceive that these washed coffees coming out of Colombia were much higher quality than natural processes coming out of, like, say, Brazil or Ethiopia. So it's really interesting how it's not just like a climate thing. It's not just a sustainability thing. Sometimes it's a politics thing. I mean, obviously political things get involved and all kinds of other perceptions about, like, this country wants to have this identity in coffee, that, you know, so a lot of other factors do get involved, but you can't see Brazil, Ethiopia. It's the geographic and weather factors.
Yeah, I mean, it starts to play into that, like, is it better or is it worse? Is washed coffees better or is natural coffees better?
Yeah, which is better, Rory?
I mean, before we tackle that, which that's up to folks to decide that. But I will say, like, what is the FNC? Like, can you explain what that is?
Yeah, so it's the FNC. I would try the Spanish pronunciation, but it would be terrible. So they are just, they oversee all the coffee growing and commerce in Colombia. So it's like the National Federation of Coffee, basically. And, you know, they do a lot of different things, from setting pricing standards to training, providing different microloans to farmers in some instances, controlling all the exports and that kind of thing, overseeing the ports and whatnot that everything's coming and going through. So, you know, in Colombia, because it's such a staple of their economy, they are a robust political force, and they can you know, they can manage a lot of what happens at a very granular level on these farms, would be, I don't want to make the comparison to Monsanto and the seeds in America, but it's kind of similar the way that, you know, we've kind of regulated, you know, you have to use these kinds of seeds in these kind of farming situations. It's a really similar idea. And I'm about to go on a really nerdy tangent that's not related, so I'm not going to do that.
What I was going to say and mention that a lot of folks talk about direct trade, and you're talking about an organization that is controlling a lot of that, what comes to us. And so, and they hold a lot of power. So
absolutely, yeah.
A lot of the financial aspect is also held within their hands too. So when we're dealing with a lot of these farmers, we're not always in coffee roasters and coffee buyers aren't dealing directly with coffee farmers typically in some of these cases. So it's
absolutely.
So it's just something interesting to think about, and that could be a different, whole different.
Yeah. You're making it really hard for me to not go on that nerdy tangent, Rory. So let's just,
I just wanted to mention that. So we talk about processing, and so how does naturally processed coffees affect flavor?
You want to take this one?
And we're not talking about Beyond yet. We're just talking about...
just the natural processes. So I guess with the cherry that it's drying with, you know, rain, sun, soil, that all plays in a factor. So that's what you're going to be tasting, really, versus like if you were to wash the coffees, like you're washing all of that off before you even get to taste it. So that's pretty much...
And then when you keep
what I'm understanding,
keep the cherry together, what is happening?
Basically ferments. And then, you know, as it's drying, you can break it apart and like you take it to a huller, and then you'll pretty much just clean it off and then go right into pack it up.
So those sugars just ferment and keep on enriching and adding flavor to coffee. And with some of this aspect, we have a rise of experimental processes, which is the Beyond aspect of this. And it just keeps getting pushed further and further afield. And it's just hard to catch up, hard to stay in it all. But we're here to try to just talk about some of it. And some of those aspects are where in the world is this popular and standard practice? I mean, we talked about Colombia, we talked about Ethiopia, we talked about Brazil. And, you know, like, what does that look like for the rest of the world?
Yeah, I think a really interesting thing is developing where you can kind of find them everywhere now. And there's plenty of experimentation happening outside of kind of the old, you know, bastions of natural or washed, whatever. And I think one of my favorite coffees this year was a natural process from Guatemala, which like was a very new idea to me. Like I love Guatemalan coffees, and I'd had a lot of washed just forever. And that's a pretty reliable flavor profile, and then I got this natural that had a lot of those very reliable flavors, but then this just crazy explosive fruitiness to it too. That was like, all right, that's a very new take, and that was really exciting for me. So I think it's proliferating. It's really becoming a much more standard practice. You know, I got a natural and a washed of the same lot of coffee from Uganda at the past couple of years, and that stuff was excellent. And I don't know, I just like so where is it, like, at this point, it's kind of everywhere. But I do think we do need to say, like, this is still a vanishingly small amount of coffee. These lots are still, like, when you're talking about, you know, millions of bags produced over, you know, the course of how many years, like, this is, like, a lot that's, like, 75 bags. This one's, like, 100 bags. You know, like, that's a really small amount. It seems like a lot to us, but, like, so these are like really niche products, and they are things that people are taking a risk on, and that they have trouble scaling in some instances. So I think that's something that's important to keep in mind. Because if you're like, well, I don't know if I've had a lot, or I don't know if I've ever had a natural, it's like, yeah, I mean, maybe, probably, if you come here to Ugly Dog, definitely, or you know, a lot of different shops like in the area or in the region. But If you're not sure you have, like, it's not as though they're kind of, you know, super common. So
would you say, like, as it rises with popularity, can't really say if it's better or worse, right?
Yeah, it's going to be up to preference.
Yeah.
It's definitely going to be up to preference.
It comes down to intention.
Yeah. And tangent avoided.
Love that. It was really hard for us to stay on track. So, like, we're doing the best we can to, like, not deep dive into these, like, granular aspects of this conversation.
Yeah. We'll have a chance to yap at you guys at the end of this.
Yes. And take questions, too, which we're excited about. Thanks for those joining. If you wanted to move forward or bring benches forward, you're more than welcome. They're also little sheets. Oh, thank you, Bob. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And this isn't amplified, but we are recording it, so for further exploration later. So, so what are some benefits and challenges that these coffee farmers and producers are going through?
I mean, production cost is going to be way lower. You're not using as much water, so you're kind of saving the environment with that.
There are sustainability benefits. I think an interesting aspect too is the naturally processed coffees take longer than like I said. I've gotten some lots that were same lot of coffee washed and natural. The natural is always coming out a little bit later, always reaching port just a little bit later. So, and there's risk as a farmer in delayed export, in delayed sale. So that's probably one of the costs of naturals. I mean, when we get into some of the beyond, I think it's a lot of risk because you don't know how these processes are going to turn out when you start them. It's a lot of risk because you might need specialized equipment, which, I mean, we can get there. But so when you're talking cost benefit, I mean, it kind of seems like a no-brainer. Like, oh, yeah, let's not use water. Great. But there's a lot more to
take to that.
Absolutely. Yeah. The labor of just keeping the coffee spread out and that. Yeah, absolutely.
So what would be the benefit of the farmers and producers besides some of the environmental impact? What would be the other benefit for them taking the leap into this process of putting energy into naturally processed coffees?
I think showcasing some aspects of the terroir within the region is going to be super important. As you know, like, different farms, they're going to be in different regions. It's going to have different soils. So they're not always going to taste the same, even if it's like a single origin from one spot.
And is there a financial benefit for those folks too?
It's an interesting question. There sure was. I mean, like, there was definitely, well, there sure could be. So a lot of coffee producers aren't selling to people based on quality. Like, that's a relatively new concept compared to the history of coffee. So if you can find, you know, people who are interested in the quality of the coffee to buy that coffee, then yeah, there's definitely financial incentive. Now, the market is so crazy right now that the naturals and washed coffees are all just, like, really expensive. So that incentive for washed and natural specifically is disappearing. But when we get into the beyond, when we get into the honeys, anaerobics, co-ferments, and whatnot that we're going to talk about, there's, like, those coffees are astronomically expensive and fetching, like, huge prices. It's impossible to scale, so they have to charge, like, as much as they can, and it's because, you know, you taste just some of the craziest things you've ever tasted in a coffee, in these coffees. So the financials of it all, just where we're at in the market, is probably one of the more fascinating points to me, because I have to figure out a budget for this stuff, right? So it's
just so volatile.
Exactly.
Unpredictable right now. It's difficult. Yeah.
So let's jump into, what is an anaerobic coffee?
So one of the chemical processes that happens in natural processing is anaerobic respiration, and just turning glucose into tasty things inside the coffee fruit. And so two ways that we can impact the rate of anaerobic respiration or impact the environment and put microorganisms in the environment with the coffee that actually perform anaerobic respiration. So the anaerobic coffees are coffees that are essentially in anaerobic environments, which means environments with no oxygen. So that creates a better environment for a higher rate of anaerobic respiration, which creates some of the tasty things that set naturals apart. They come out in much higher concentrations in anaerobics, and they're just unmistakably more fruity, unmistakably more candy-like, unmistakably, you know, hitting a much more interesting depth of flavor.
Yeah, so it definitely enhances those flavors, but not necessarily improving them all the time. I think since you, like, seal it in the tank with no oxygen, you can also put in CO2 to really drive out that oxygen. And that would be, like, carbon.
Yeah, that's carbonic, a carbonic maceration. Yep, yeah. That's usually, that's the term for that one. Shout out Jared Thurber for teaching me about that with wine, like, 12 years ago. Like, that's pretty awesome.
Which it is a big thing in the wine industry as well. So if you're familiar with that, there's...
Yeah, we're starting to borrow things from wine.
Yeah. And we've been talking about wine and coffee for decades at this point and trying to compare the two, keep them at the same... Or at least try to engage people. I think coffee people trying to bring people into coffee, be like, no, it's like wine. It's been that way for decades, for me anyway. Trying to get people to come along into that conversation. And now we're using the same language. Because natural wines have an impact in conversation piece across the world at this point with biodynamics and all of that. So that's a whole nother industry and a whole nother conversation. But it does matter. And so what...
I want to hear about co-ferments.
Yeah.
Yeah, Nan has a lot more experience with co-ferments.
So let's talk about... Before we get there, there's the one aspect that we talked about was raising... Let's talk about coffee grading. Coffee's graded, right? And let's talk about what the anaerobic process is doing to those graded coffees.
Yeah, so in a recent article, it was found that the anaerobic process actually raised the cupping scores of underripe coffees. So if the cherry was pulled off the tree too early, processing it as an anaerobic, actually, and then, you know, putting it through its paces and sending it to a roaster and having them cup it, they were grading it way higher, which is great in one sense, because there is just some inconsistency. You know, it's very hard to train pickers who are, you know, unfortunately not making a whole lot of money doing their job. Don't pull these green cherries off. Go look for the red ones, especially if you're paying them, you know, per pound in their basket every day. So, which happens all over the world. So we've been trying to push training more. And now it's like, well, actually, maybe we can make up for some of the inconsistency on the back end through anaerobic processing. But then that gets interesting. It's like, are you feeding this notion that, oh, it's okay, just pick whatever and, you know, we'll process it anaerobic, it'll be fine. And are we leaving a lot of quality on the table that way? But does it matter? You know, if it comes out and it's higher quality, does it matter?
And how I see it too is instead of the farmers discarding this to a different market where they're getting less money, they're actually getting the money that they put into the coffee by raising that cupping score, and it's benefiting from them in that long run. So,
yeah.
So there's that plus and minus. It's a really interesting conversation, and valid to this conversation. Good touch point. But now on to co-ferments.
Co-ferments.
What is a co-ferment?
So basically you would ferment these coffees with other fruits, or like you can do spices as well. And that typically enhances the taste of the coffee in the final cup to what you fermented it with. So if you fermented it with watermelon, it's probably going to give you a watermelon like Jolly Rancher, super candy-like. Same thing. You can do like lavender. People do oranges. I brought one from Yellow Rooster. It's I forgot all of them, but it's lychee, rose, and a couple of other ones. Yeah, super, super crazy flavors in there. Sometimes one noted, but it can also just be muddled up together. Yeah.
So similar motivations and to move into that market as anaerobics, if I'm not mistaken, right? And then what are some of the risks and transparency concerns that we have with those processes?
In terms of motivations, like, you know, this process, co-fermenting is new. It's kind of shiny. We're like, ooh, like, you know, we don't really know that much on it just yet. But in terms of, I think, concerns and, like, risks, it's harder to replicate everything at 100%, so you're not going to have, like, consistency with it. Yeah.
And when we get to the consumer side, how can someone identify or take a look at something? What is what? Like, is there a standardization? What are we looking at on that side of things? Not as a two, we're not going to deep dive into this. We're just going to touch on this topic.
In terms of, like, labeling on packages, I mean, I feel like most roasters will label it as co-ferments, but there are some that don't say anything about co-fermentation at all. So, like, how do you really know, right? Because,
like, well, and I think you make a really good point about the shiny new toy thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, and Aaron and Chris and I, we have a podcast where we tasted through a coffee that it had the name of a cocktail on it. You know, it was just, this was a painkiller cocktail, and that's what it was meant to replicate.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, what? How did they do that? What is this? And it's not on the bag, how they replicated it. And then you go to the website and you find out it's like, was it like four or five different, like four different co-ferments? So like, there is kind of like a...
It's a Wild West.
Yeah, like it's a whole new thing, and so people are writing their own rules, and it's like, we're just going to market this coffee based on the flavor. Well, it turns out it had all this other stuff in there at some point. So, you know, take that how you will, better or worse, right?
Yeah, risky on the transparency on things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think, so you both said it's a new process. It's something that the industry is grappling with as a whole, which I find very intriguing. And the best way to kind of navigate that is try to build partnerships and try to trust each other and, you know, be honest about what that is in the cup. Like, if you're working coffee and you're working with roasters or someone that's brewing coffee, like, talk about it, because we're not going to progress past this new shiny thing until we smooth out those edges, which, you know, we hope to try to do.
Yeah. Uphill battle sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. In the grand scheme, too, we're talking about all these processes, and this came up in the conversation for us is, you know, in this region alone, like, where are we finding these coffees to buy from, like, roasters and coffee shops to buy from in the area to taste from?
Bigger cities, I feel like, typically will have these co-ferments just because of demand from, you know, obviously if you're going to go out to California, like San Diego has Dark Horse Coffee Roasters. They did a co-ferment and that was insane. I really liked that one, but that, like, having that here, nobody really has that here, at least in the store. So,
yeah, I think we've talked about how the ones we've brought in,
yeah,
are sort of just like, yay, boss let us off the leash a little bit, and
yeah,
we got like a fun coffee that we kind of understand is not like our number one moneymaker, but is something that can create interest and create a conversation. And so you have to look at things kind of beyond the bottom line for the value of some of these coffees, which is like, it makes sense to me. Pretty unintuitive to some people. So that can be why I think in markets the size of Rochester, I dare say Buffalo, Syracuse, you know, like it's vanishingly small samples.
Yeah. I mean, even for the co-ferments, it's kind of just like a fun thing, like pushing curiosities, trying to drive the industry a little forward. So it's not really a big money maker.
So science versus fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Science is fun.
Science is fun.
So that's something we touched about, like this purest idea of what coffee is and what we've typically have found it to be understood as is like that beverage that we consume daily and this other wild thing that we're chasing. So this like thing that we want people to take seriously. And then also, but we also want to have fun and just throw things at a wall to see what sticks too sometimes. So, we were going to touch upon this thing because this also moves the industry forward. Coffee competitions, nationally, internationally, this is where you really find a lot of these coffees. And can we talk about that a little bit and what that looks like and how that moves our industry forward?
Yeah, I mean, we talked a little bit about the SCAP 86ing, like co-ferments out of competitions. If you want to elaborate a little bit more on
that. So the Specialty Coffee Association of Panama hosts a producer competition every year called Best of Panama, and it's been huge for getting really unique coffees to market and getting ridiculously high. I mean, these are like the ones that make the headlines, high prices at some of these auctions. And just this past year, they said no co-ferments, no thermal shocks, which is another process that we've not even had time to touch on. And honestly, I don't know a whole lot about, so hiding my ignorance.
Was that on the basis of like alternating the DNA, which it...
So what they said, the phrase they used was it alters the genetic expression.
Okay.
And if you want the genetic expression of a coffee tree, eat a cherry off of the branch. Because everything we're doing is altering the genetic expression. I would think everything has some kind of impact, so where do you draw the line? I don't think it's a really fair line to draw. You know, it really in large part focused on one producer who's been a pioneer of a lot of different processing methods. And so it looked a lot like everyone not wanting him to get out in front of them. And that's just from, you know, I was not in Panama for any of this. So that's just what it looked like for me or to me, just hearing, you know, all the different sides the way that I heard them. So there is that. I'm just going to take one quick tangent here because it's really interesting to be in like third wave specialty coffee. And we were always telling people like, don't add milk. You know, not we were telling people don't add milk. We were like, try it before you add milk. You know, just the natural qualities of the coffee, you know, like try it before you add sugar. You might not need as much because everything about this coffee is, you know, soil, weather patterns, elevation, this, that, the other thing, processing, obviously, we would talk about when we would talk about these things. And now we're like, we're going to add stuff. Just before. And it's like, and we're all excited about it. So it's interesting kind of the way the wheel turns.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah. I mean, are we just kind of conceding that it's like, it's okay to, like you said, play a little bit and the science of it is really cool. And I, you know, I could read about it forever. So I don't know.
I mean, we can still honor the traditions and have fun. So
yeah, absolutely.
But like a lot of the winning coffees in these competitions are naturally processed coffees, so, and beyond, and hopefully maybe even further beyond at some point. So let's talk about some of the disconnects between roasters, disconnects between guests that come into our cafes and coffee shops, and even between folks working in coffees and roasters. Like, what have you seen, Nan, like you being a director of coffee, working with a variety of folks, what does that look like for you as... What are people asking for, and so on and so forth?
Well, I guess working with cafes, it comes down to, you know, are we responsible to teach the cafes, teach the baristas? Or are the baristas responsible for teaching the demographic that they're serving, right? whose shoulder does it really fall on, right? But I definitely think that the disconnect really comes down to, are we curious enough? Are we learning more about coffee? And I mean, with all you guys here, not everyone is in the coffee industry, which is really awesome to see. So I think now that we're talking more and more about it, more people are listening, more people are getting curious, and that's really what it comes down to.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing is to feel comfortable to ask those questions openly and honestly in a cafe setting, if possible, and then also to the folks that are roasting or you're connected with in the coffee industry. Just come with a curious, open mind. I think that's the huge part of breaking down those barriers. So now we're moving on to this. Is it trendy? Are we just chasing that like fun new thing because it's new and exciting? Is it good conversation? And I've been a person where in the past been like, natural coffees aren't for me. I don't love them. And I think we're at a space now where a lot of producers, a lot of farmers, a lot of roasters, we've gotten to a point where they understand naturally processed coffee so much more now. It's so much more nuanced. I can appreciate it so much more. I'm understanding of it where now I'm at the co-ferment side. I'm like, and the anaerobic side, we're like, is this good? I don't know if I really like this. Where I'm a slow grower here. So like, how are we navigating this in the industry?
Yeah, I think that it is fascinating when we see these new things come out because like probably 70 to 80% of the first kind of waves that we get of these things are bad. Like that's my experience. Like I have way more bad examples than good. And you do want to shy away and be like, oh, I mean like all these different gradations of honey processes. I don't know about all that. And then the longer they're around and the more they kind of circulate in the market, eventually kind of, you know, the cream rises, right? So like the ones that are actually really good stick around and they fetch higher market prices and they get more investment and then best practices sort of filter down and we refine. And so I think this was definitely my experience with anaerobics. I was about done with anaerobics after like the first three that I tried. I was like, this is not good. Like, I don't know why everyone's going crazy about this. This is not good. And then I got one from Honduras from a producer that I've worked with, and it was just lights out, stellar, fantastic blackberry flavor to it that I was just in love with. So it's like, okay, maybe there's some hope for these. And I think they're coming around a lot more now. I think like there's a lot more standardization to how it's done. And so it does come in waves. I think probably, I wonder how many co-ferments I would really like right now. And I wonder how many I will in like 3 or 4 years.
I would say I would like personally probably like more in 3 or 4 years.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's kind of like a car where you're like, you know, a certain model in a certain year, it's not going to be as good as the previous ones, you know, tried and true, but you'll eventually develop better tech or create a better car.
So what we're saying here is that the market share for these types of coffees is minute. Like ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they drive a lot of the conversation excitement in the coffee industry right now, which is really fascinating. And these are the coffees that you see at competition as well. So that's also fascinating, but they're such a small part of what folks do. And they're such a small part of any region serving it. Because from what you all see, the market share isn't looking for it from you all.
Yeah. No, I have no audience for this in general.
Yeah.
Not compared here. Compared to everything else I roast. Yeah.
So it's interesting.
Another interesting point about that is like that wasn't really possible before. All processing had to be scalable. The reason we came up with natural and washed is because it was super scalable. You could do it on masse. You could get lots of coffee out with those processes. anaerobic's a lot harder. You know, if you have to shut it up in some kind of chamber and not allow oxygen to it, that's a lot more difficult to scale. And so it is kind of cool to see these non-scalable processes start to filter in and fetch prices where producers have to worry less about getting more and more and more out there. Because obviously that's taxing on labor, that's taxing on the soils, that's taxing on, you know, their whole, all of their infrastructure. So, which is usually very aged infrastructure, you know, like all of their equipment is usually older than the person running the farm. So, that's, I think that's an interesting way forward for us.
Yeah. So now we didn't touch on one thing, but I think it's time to open up the Q&A aspect. Cool. So we want to invite you all to ask any questions that you may have. Once again, these aren't amplified microphones. They are just for recording purposes. So if you want to use a mic to ask a question, feel free, or I will re-communicate it to the microphone. So whatever is easiest for you. Is anyone brave enough to ask a question?
Whole latte love crew coming through. Yeah, specifically the article was dealing with underripes and you know, cherries that were picked underripe. So I'm not privy to a lot of like the scoring and how it's trending vis-a-vis the co-ferments. Have you seen any scores? Mm. Like, yeah. So I don't know. I do think it's interesting. This is related, I promise. We talk about coffee scoring, but the industry is kind of changing the way that we evaluate and score coffees. And there's like kind of a new, we're integrating new insights from sensory science to say like, well, there's as intersubjective or objective as we can try to be about flavor and intensity. And then there's this affective side, like do people actually like the thing they're tasting. I would have to imagine that no matter where the intensity of co-ferments lies, people are like fascinated and loving them. Like I would like, just because the aspect of like a coffee can taste like that, it wears, you know, I've been doing it for too long. So it wears on me. I'm like, I just want, you know, like I just want balance and I just want, you know, these specific characteristics. But I think like I could see a situation where co-ferments were super high affective scores, people just really loving them, but maybe they were too intense or too one note or certain things were out of balance. So, and again, that's guess. That's a guess. That wasn't in the article I read, but that's a great question. Something to look into.
And I would say like anaerobics came a bit before co-ferments, so that's probably why we have more information on those right now in that specific lane.
I feel like I get really excited about co-ferments just because like that could be a segue for people to start enjoying coffee, like kind of a soft launch for them. They're like, wow, I've never had a coffee like this. I really like it. And now they're going to, you know, snowball into all the other parts of coffee. And that's what really... what we want to do here is get more people to be curious and drink more coffee.
Yeah, so I think the interesting thing that Wade came up with about even that purist versus, you know, experimental fun aspect is a roaster making a coffee that after a cocktail, which you could never do before a co-ferment situation. And I bet you someone is willing to try that before they're willing to try, like, willing to try that black and unsweetened and uncommingled before they would, like, a regular drip black coffee. So I think that's the win, right?
Absolutely. And for in-country competitions, I there's a lot of, like, separating out the washed and the natural. We do that. Why not separate out the co-ferment? You know, all the co-ferments against one another. Why not set boundaries where it has to be a product grown in country so that it participates in the same terroir? If you're really trying to bring out the terroir, those, you know, oranges grown on the other farm or whatever they might be, maybe that's what you should be asked to use, right? So that it all kind of stays true to that country's expression. Because that's kind of what they were saying in Panama. This isn't Panamanian coffee. This isn't the expression we're going for with Panamanian coffee. And there are ways to control that, I think, that would benefit everyone. And we can just have more super expensive auction lots that are way more beneficial for more farmers, I think. But, you know, no one's asking me other than you guys.
I think coffee has experimented with, like, aging in whiskey barrels, which, you know, Joe Bean did You know, so there's always been some sort of coffee industry folks reaching out, seeing what we can, how we can further this industry. Because, like, we said this process is niche. Specialty coffee is also niche compared to coffee in the landscape, too. So this is, like, a niche within a niche, within, a huge industry. So I think that's a really interesting take. But, yes, I think I can speak to all of us here. We want to see the coffee industry that we're involved in grow further and expand and reach more people, because that has better effect for a lot of people involved in the industry.
So. Yeah, it definitely sets the tone to keep experimenting and keep having fun. I mean, with the market, how it's right now, like these co-ferments, you know, green, they can be about $11.50, $15 even, and that's crazy. That's an insane cost.
So for someone that doesn't know, so $11.15 green, what's an average price of a wash coffee?
Right now, I've been looking around like $7 to $8. Yeah.
I was able to reserve some that was like high fives when I reserved it, and that's just like a steal right now.
So
yeah.
So I mean, double if not a little
been different.
Yeah.
So, the price of coffee in general is rising, and I think there's folks in this room that have been working in coffee for a long time that knew that to be true and knew that to be happening and are okay with that. But there is a sense of doom and gloom about that. And so it's an interesting time in this space when it's ramped up so much in so little time. So
yeah, and it's always snapped back by now. That's kind of the most interesting thing, is that we've always participated in a super volatile market, gets too expensive, demand goes down, price snaps back. And it's just plateaued. We just live here now in these soups, much higher prices. And it's probably forces way beyond anything, you know, that the market can even touch that are causing that. I actually wonder much more about the farmer who has to decide, do I sell to the FNC or do I take this risk on anaerobics? One quick anecdote, I was actually talking with a farmer about a coffee that I just really loved in Colombia, and they ended up selling to the FNC. Just because it's like, they were like, well, the market's going to, you know, do so much better. And I was not sustainable enough, you know. I my small roastery can't buy whole huge plots of coffee, so... It's an interesting, I don't know. I thought if I offered the high enough price that I would get this coffee I really loved, and it went right through my fingers. So I actually think it's going to go the other way, where all we're going to, you know, we're going to lose more specialty coffee than we're going to, then we're going to see people going, we might as well, because there's no might as well with the bottom line, I think, at the end of the day. So.
Coffee trends to avoid. I don't think you should avoid anything, to be honest. This goes back to that fun aspect. If something's exciting and it seems cool, I would say try it somewhere else first than investing in a lot of stuff for it. Okay, so how about for business perspective, for me, does it connect with your mission? Does it connect with what you want to do? Does it interrupt service? Does it interrupt the people serving the coffee to you? The shiny new thing isn't always going to be the best for your business and isn't going to show you value in return. It shows you chasing, which in my opinion isn't always in the long run going to give you that longevity and return on value. That's my perspective. I don't know if you all, I know you both have heard me say, always lean back into your mission and who you are and what you are. Doesn't mean your mission can't change, but there has to be some sense of your identity within the scope of it.
Yeah. I mean, you got to put your passion behind it. Right. And, the pursuit of excellence in coffee, is so costly. So, yeah, I would agree. I wouldn't avoid any trends. Like, I would test it out and try it. If it doesn't hit, if it's a miss, it's a miss. It doesn't mean that you can't try again later anyway.
If it requires equipment, specialized equipment, yeah, then don't jump quite yet.
I was going to say something along these lines.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are all the things. Don't pivot too hard, because revenue can be really tempting, but it comes with additional overhead from equipment or materials or ingredients. So I think that's the biggest trap I keep seeing people fall into, is they're pivoting to this food item. They're pivoting to, you know, blenders and things like that. And like, maybe for some, there's like a market space there for them, and it works out in the long term. But sorry, Rory, I hold up Ugly Duck as an example. Like, we just do coffee. We have coffee and pastries, right? Like, and Rory, have people asked you to do food?
Too many times.
So, and it's like, would the revenue not be tempting, right? Like, just see, like, you know, turn that day into like a 50% plus day, right? Like, neat.
I mean, I can just say, where am I going to put it?
Yeah, exactly. There are a lot of other considerations. Make sure, you know, you're not just focused on, I have to hit these numbers this many days a week. And that is the biggest, I think, trap I see people falling into in coffee, is like, I understand you want to work it out that way, and then you want to turn that into a trend line and turn that into a sustainable business. But at the end of the day, all of that comes with additional costs, and just don't jump too quickly. And you can slog it out for 10 years just doing coffee. It is possible. Like, you just have to, you know, it works if you work it.
And not to be chasing food item trends, but also, like you said, equipment. So there's been a lot of tech in coffee, which some of it's great. But also what happens in tech and coffee is it gets bought out by bigger tech and then it goes away, or bigger corporations and it goes away. There was a beautiful brewer called the Clover Brewer decade ago, and a big company bought it, and it's no longer available. Parts are no longer available. So anyone that has one of those, even though it's a great thing, can't even repair it anymore, can't keep it up anymore, because they took it away. There's new tech all the time. There's different brewers coming out all the time, and they get bought up or they just sunset. And so...
Where's your nitro line, Rory?
We don't have a nitro
line. Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, that's a tempting trend, though, and people like it.
Yeah. Where can you get nitro cold brew in town anymore?
Churchville. Plug.
I mean, but that was a big thing for a long time, nitro cold brew. Bars had it. You know, it was everywhere. Now, you know, now it's feasible to have a canned option of it, but that's a trend that people chased, invested in, and now it's gone away. Just like Snap or whatever. Social media is a trend, you know, people jump on it, Vine, it's gone, you know, I mean, like, all these things, like, they're fleeting, you know, marketers will pitch ideas to you to invest in, this is going to help your business, it's like, is it? I don't know, you know, so, I mean, there's so
it's
many...
It's going to help your business.
There's so many trends that are thrown to a lot of businesses, and especially in the coffee sector, because we touch so many bases and we touch so many lives, it's very interesting. It's not just coffee. It's a person-to-person business. And I think that conversation can be a whole different conversation we can get into, of, you know, chasing what other people are doing, what it looks like they're doing, how successful are they, to actually... Are they successful? I don't know. Are they buried under debt? Do they have investors? Who knows? Like, that's such a big thing. Yeah. What's going to disappear? I think regionally we've kind of seen a sudden setting of single cup options. I don't know if that's going to disappear or come back in some capacity. But as far as disappearing, I don't know. I don't think of things in that regard. I'm not chasing a dragon in our industry, or trying to see things go away. Maybe I'm not that close to it, to be honest.
And I feel like, sadly, a lot of pour overs, I don't really see a lot in stores anymore, shops. Because, I mean, you know, labor is a huge thing. And, you know, you're going to be buying these pour overs for $8, $10 at the minimum. And you start getting into ice pour overs. And now it's blown up to like $12, $14 because you're using a little bit more product in that. It's not because of the ice. But, yeah, it comes down to time and labor. So, yeah.
Yeah, I can't really think of anything. I'm racking my brain here. What's the next thing to disappear? Hopefully not me.
As I'm a perpetual like optimist, and Wade could probably tell you this. In our years, we play like double-sided coin, where like I'm that and he is the other side typically. And so like I try not to hold too much space for that. And now I'm bummed out. I can't think of something that I really want to like put something there. Tampers.
Oh yeah, you win.
I will preach the choir on this. Everyone get an automatic tamper. That
saves your body.
Sorry, Quinn. Quinn makes some awesome tampers.
They do. Yeah. If you're a home barista, great. Have a tamper. But man, if you're in a shop, get a puck press or some other type of thing. Save yourself, save your body, add consistency. They're great. That's my hot take.
I kind of think there might be some menu streamlining coming too. Flat white macchiato, cortado, like where I'm just getting tired of it. And I think a lot of people are getting tired of it. And like, I yearn for the days when I had two sizes of latte, a cappuccino, and then a macchiato on the menu, and someone could come in and say, "Just get a little less milk in that," and you would just make it that way. And then you knew what the hell they were talking. Excuse me, knew what they were talking about first of all, but you also there's a lot more mutual understanding to that than someone coming in with a really esoteric definition of one of these words that we keep just needing more of apparently on our menus. So I would hope some of that will disappear, and we'll just get back to like. Just ask for it the way you want it.
I love Wade's takes, even if I don't agree with them. I don't see that happening, but does anyone else have any questions? Aaron, that want our answers anyway.
Yeah, this is for the audience now. I'm curious if these unique processing methods might be, in a way, able to save smaller farms, or if it's going to be more of a detriment to them in terms of either increasing what they are able to produce or not being able to keep up type thing.
It's really, really rare for us to actually connect with like a real true like small farmer. When you get into the size of the farms, it has always been kind of the middle to largest kind of specialty farms that are benefiting from what we do. We've never really been able to break through that. The smallest farms, they're inaccessible. They have traditions of only dealing with regulated bodies, so groups that they can sell to in country. And I think small farms have been left behind by, you know, specialty coffee from the word go. So I think that's unfortunately going to continue to happen because I haven't seen, you know, how is a small farmer going to invest in the tanks needed to perform carbonic maceration? You know, I haven't seen any evidence that there's anyone micro-targeting that kind of investment in their countries. Personally, maybe I'm wrong there. That'd be another avenue for conversation. But it is really, it's really kind of the thing we hide, the truth behind the veil really for us is that we're still not making that micro targeted impact. We're still dealing with medium to large size producers.
I just want to say thank you all so much for showing up. This is awesome. Thank you. Like, truly, this has been amazing. I know Bob does have some coffee to brew up if you want to stick around. If you, I will also jump on a Chemex, but if that is something that interests you all, I know Wayne and Nan both brought some coffees to taste, but also feel free to chat and introduce yourselves to each other. Take these little sheets home with you if you find them intriguing. Thank you so much.
Thanks, y'all.
Thank you.
This has been a presentation of the Lunch Hour Podcast Network.